to the Richard Nixon Experience.
If the United States betrays the millions of people who have relied on us in Vietnam, the President of the United States, whoever he is, will not deserve nor receive the respect which is essential if the United States is to continue to play the great role we are destined to play of helping to build a new structure of peace in the world. It would amount to a renunciation of our morality, an abdication of our leadership among nations, and an invitation for the mighty to prey upon the weak all around the world.
Assumed the presidency in January 1969, the nation was at war and the world seemed on the brink of nuclear catastrophe. It was the greatest set of challenges facing any incoming president since the end of the Second World War.
Mr. President, America's involvement in Vietnam was regarded by many as a disaster. It was splitting American society at home in a very grievous way for what seemed to many an obscure or even a mistaken reason. How did it look to you, though?
Well, it looked to me first that the reason for our being in Vietnam had perhaps not been adequately understood by the American people. I thought first that Kennedy and Johnson were right in going in Vietnam. I was very critical of the way the war had been conducted. I thought they could have done, particularly President Johnson, because, of course, he had the major responsibility. We were in deeper by the time he was president, that they could have conducted it in a more effective way. I had some ideas as to what could be done, but I wasn't about to go down that easy political path of bugging out, blaming it on my predecessors. It would have been enormously popular in America, but that would have paid, had been at an enormous cost, eventually even to America, but particularly to the whole free world.
But wasn't staying there, I mean, that was also at a massive cost, wasn't it, in billions of dollars, in 138,000 South Vietnamese killed, half a million Cambodians, half a million North Vietnamese, and so on. That cost, it's a question of weighing one cost against another cost, isn't it? But it you is. Thought that cost was worth paying for what you got.
It was worth it in terms of the period in which I had the responsibility. Let me be quite candid about it. The most popular position to take in Vietnam, if I was simply playing to the votes and playing to popular opinion in the world, was to bug out and blame it on Johnson and Kennedy.
I know.
And I didn't do it. Now, the most popular position for me to take now is to say the whole venture in Vietnam, everything that we did, was a waste of men, that it was, that it showed the United States at its worst. It cost us a great deal of money. We were morally wrong to be there, go there in the first place. Morally wrong to continue it as long as we did. And it wasn't worth it. And I could say that. And many, perhaps, of those, and that's probably a majority of our viewers who agree with that, might applaud. Even some of my critics, who, many of whom I have, and many of whom I have earned. But I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it because I don't believe it. I don't believe that this was a war that I can tote up the advantages and disadvantages and say overwhelmingly this is a war that had to be fought and that we had a successful outcome. I can't say that because It was a very complex situation. It was complex at the beginning. It was difficult throughout. I know what Johnson went through and how he agonized over the war.
Hi, I'm Randall Wallace, your host for the Richard Nixon Experience and for the Randall Wallace Presents podcast. We want to welcome you to our new introduction to the Nixon and Watergate series. This series rebroadcast will coincide with the 50th anniversary of the resignation of President Richard Nixon. When we produced and broadcast this originally in 2022, we were often learning as we went because much of the information was new and it was just coming out. In this, our rebroadcast, we're going to have the benefit of already knowing much of the newer material. Also, even more new information that has come out while we were producing things is there. And we know that information, and it continues to shine light, not only on the facts of Watergate and its ramifications, but also on the ramifications of the policies of a half century ago. Richard Nixon always said that history would vindicate him and show him as one of America's great presidents. And it has. Never in the history has a leader who fell from such a high place seen his record so totally vindicated, and not just on Watergate, but on Vietnam too. In fact, his strategies have been vindicated in every policy area imaginable today. For years, all we've heard was what might have been's. What might have been if Robert F. Kennedy had lived? How much better America would have been today if that had happened? But today we know the answer to that question in a way we didn't a half century ago. We see it today, the RFK policy of abandoning our allies in Vietnam. We see it today in RFK's policies in a Justice Department that targets an American citizen and then goes and finds the crime. And we also see it today in the strength that Richard Nixon brought to the presidency, peace with honor, strength around the world, or simply doing the right thing in the Justice Department here at home when you're trying to administer justice. And today we can see exactly why President Lyndon Johnson and President Richard Nixon were both so much more afraid of the horrendous ramifications of ever following or allowing an RFK kind of policy to take over this government. We see it today, every day, in what we see happening right now.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies. I run because I am convinced that this country is on a perilous course, and because I have such strong feelings about what must be done, and I feel that I'm obliged to do all that I can. I run to seek new policies to end the bloodshed in Vietnam and in our cities, policies to close the gaps that now exist between black and white, between rich and poor, between young and old, in this country and around the rest of the world. I run for the presidency because I want the Democratic Party and the United States of America to stand for hope instead of despair, for reconciliation of men instead of the growing risk of world war.
Richard Nixon came to office in 1968 having made a promise to President Lyndon Johnson that he would stand with him, that together they would stop the high water mark of communism and stop its spread across Southeast Asia. Richard Nixon stuck by that promise even in these interviews in 1975.
Nixon was up, way up in the polls, until September 30th, when Hubert Humphrey turned the tide with this speech.
I want to talk with you about Vietnam.
Humphrey repudiated Lyndon Johnson's war policy.
As president, I would stop the bombing of the North as an acceptable risk for peace.
The announcement would narrow the polls dramatically. Nixon immediately had an unexpected order for his personal aide, Dwight Chapin.
Get President Johnson on the phone.
Who did he say that to?
He said it to me. I had no idea what to do, so I asked Rose Woods, who was Nixon's secretary. She said, call 456-1414 in Washington.
That's the White House number.
That's the White House number, and asked to speak to the president.
Mr. President?
Yes.
I'm awfully sorry to bother you. This is Dick Nixon.
Yes, Dick.
President Johnson was recording the call as Nixon discussed Humphrey's speech.
This will be interpreted, as I'm sure you know, as a dramatic move away from the administration. It's my intention not to move in that direction.
Did you have a sense of how strange that call was?
I felt that it was one of the most intriguing political maneuvers that I had ever heard. For Richard Nixon to be calling Lyndon Johnson, and he's telling the president, I'm with you, not exactly the words, but implying it.
Mondale thinks it's evidence that Johnson might have been rooting against his own party's nominee, his own vice president.
Do you think Johnson wanted Humphrey to win?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I think at the end, the last 2 weeks, he wanted him to win. But I think the early part of the campaign, he was mad at Humphrey. He thought Humphrey wasn't being loyal enough.
Do you think Johnson wanted Nixon to win?
I thought so for a while because he was doing things to help Nixon.
Richard Nixon reiterated it again in 1968 after winning the election.
Well, of course, the point
I haven't stayed in this thing 5 years to throw it away the last 5 weeks.
The point is, too, that you've always, your position has always been basically, as I told you, you've taken the position which was extremely unpopular and which was right. And so therefore, I want to support you on it. We're going to do it. And there's no question about that. I want you to know that.
Thank you, Dick.
So you might say, what does that prove? How does that vindicate Richard Nixon? Well, today, you have a disciple of Robert F. Kennedy in the White House, in Joe Biden. You have a president who, as a senator, cut the funding, led in cutting the funding to Vietnam, to South Vietnam, so that what happened there in 1975 would happen. And that is the invasion of the North into the South and the taking over of Vietnam. But if you want to see the peacenik policies that have been preached and taught in our schools, because if you haven't noticed, all these college professors of the last 50 years were all those hippies and rather underground people that were involved in fighting the Nixon administration and saying that he was wrong and have been preaching this for 50 years with the help of the national media. Well, now we know what could and would have happened had Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon hadn't stuck together to make sure that that kind of mentality did not get into the White House. You want to see what happens? Here's what happens.
The chaotic and deadly U.S. evacuation from Afghanistan stunned Americans and the world and cost the lives of 13 U.S. soldiers. Now a damning new report blames the Biden administration for being slow to evacuate U.S. citizens and Afghan allies, according to an Army investigation first obtained by the Washington Post. One national security official saying an evacuation would signal we have failed. According to the report, 3 days before Kabul fell, Rear Admiral Peter Vasily, the top commander in Afghanistan, sounding alarms to acting U.S. Ambassador Ross Wilson. But another military official telling investigators the embassy needed to position for withdrawal and the ambassador didn't get it. Congress has now ordered a broader investigation.
When did the State Department start to increase the processing of those who are seeking to immigrate to the United States? Was there anyone in the White House who was holding up the processing by sending the signal saying, don't wrap this up or ramp it up?
The report also citing testimony from an Army officer who went door to door at the U.S. Embassy on August 15th, the day Kabul fell, urging staff to get ready to leave. But says some were, quote, intoxicated and cowering in rooms.
The military is saying very clearly that the State Department was very slow, unwilling to recognize the urgency of evacuating the embassy.
The fundamental problem is that we decided to leave Afghanistan precipitously without a plan to get people out. And that's everybody's fault.
Tonight, dozens of Americans are still stranded in Afghanistan, along with thousands of Afghan allies, including many women protesters at risk, but not permitted by the U.S. on the flights taking people out. Ambassador Wilson was not available for comment,
But the State Department says cherry-picked comments don't reflect the months of work that was already underway or what U.S. diplomats did to evacuate U.S. citizens and Afghan allies.
Shocking scenes of desperation and chaos in Afghanistan are being seen around the world. Can't believe my eyes, says the man who shot this video of people clinging to an American cargo jet as it takes off. Machine gun fire could be heard as thousands of panic-stricken Afghans stormed the airport. They battled their way onto civilian planes, which took off with hundreds of passengers jammed inside. One air traffic controller marveled as a pilot ferried 800 people to Dubai in a plane designed for 150.
800 people on your jet? Holy cow.
There were more scenes of panic as night fell, and thousands more fought to get on any plane going anywhere. Caught in the maelstrom are reporters for American TV networks, including courageous women like CBS News correspondent Roxana Saberi.
For security reasons, our hotel is under lockdown at the moment. That's why I'm speaking to you from my room. The situation outside is very volatile.
I spoke to PBS correspondent Jane Ferguson.
I've covered many wars and revolutions and crises around the world, and I've never seen anything like what I'm seeing here or what I'm having to deal with here as a professional.
ABC's Ian Panel described the eerie scene in Kabul.
Well, we've just been out onto the streets. The most striking thing out there is we didn't see one single woman. Half the population is now hiding behind closed doors.
There's deep fear. You know, the Taliban have had an assassination campaign against professional women, women in particular, who have a very strong presence.
Signage at this beauty salon in downtown Kabul is being whitewashed over. This 12-year-old girl was in tears as she told the world, "No one cares about us." And here they are, the new rulers of Afghanistan, taking over the presidential palace. A humiliating end to 20 years of American leadership in a faraway land.
Again, you see what happens when we don't provide leadership. When Richard Nixon was there, we had peace in Vietnam, an honor. China was our ally, and the Soviets were at our feet, looking to cut a deal. Has the world changed? Two schools of thought in foreign policy, the RFK school, the Richard Nixon school. Right now, Hamas has invaded, or tried to invade Israel, and they're at war. There's war in Ukraine, and the Chinese are saber-rattling in Taiwan. There's your answer. And today, Richard Nixon has been vindicated. And that's not the only area. The main area, of course, is what happened in Watergate.
Right after rejecting that, they said we still need something. So I was told to look around for somebody to go over to 1701 and do this. And that's when I came up with Gordon Liddy, who they need a lawyer. Gordon had an intelligence background from his FBI service. I was aware of the fact that he had done some extremely sensitive things for the White House while he'd been at the White House, and he had apparently done them well.
Gordon Liddy was not hired by John Dean. I don't know where that idea came from. John Dean certainly was involved. John Dean certainly has suffered and paid the price for his admission of his culpability and his role in this. But he became a prosecution witness. He totally cooperated. And so there's just a lot of things there that are just not true.
Now, Jim Wildbanks does sum that up pretty good. There's a lot of things there that are just not true. And what you're going to find as we go through this series is how often you find out things that just aren't true. Now, in that little diatribe, you will hear her say, she doesn't know where that came from. Where did this idea that John Dean hired G. Gordon Liddy come from? I would suggest right here.
So I was told to look around for somebody to go over to 1701 and do this. And that's when I came up with Gordon Liddy.
For those of you who may not know who that is, that's John Dean. He was the counsel to the president. He is a central player in Watergate. He turned state's evidence and basically threw under the bus Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, John Mitchell, and the president. And he has duly earned himself a place of infamy in the Nixon administration. and he was able to walk away basically scot-free. We're going to go through his role in this whole situation, but the lady talking, Jill Winebanks, was one of the prosecutors. And as you listen to our show, you will find that she is one of many prosecutors who's willing to get on television and say things that they used to say about Franklin Roosevelt, a terminological inexactitude. And that is about as good a description as I could come up with for these prosecutors. And you will hear them do this over and over and over again, which is something that I learned doing the production of this series the first time, because this series, you're going to hear two things a lot. That is, you're going to hear from the actual Nixon tapes, and you're going to hear from the oral histories. And in these oral histories, we chose Jill Winebanks, Henry Ruth, Phil Lockevar briefly because I didn't have a total oral history with him, and of course, Richard Benvenisti, who is the king of the terminological inexactitude and arrogant beyond words. And I will just leave it at he is one of the most disgusting people, in my opinion, that you will hear from in this series. But I think it's important to point something, this issue with him especially out, because he is insulting, he's arrogant. He will talk about people like myself who have done this research as people who are rewriting history, revisionists, that Nixon should have been prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law so that he would have been forced to admit and a pardon that he had committed crimes, so that there would be no way to defend him years later. And you got to remember that when President Nixon left office, he was left flat broke. He was very, very sick and somewhat depressed, but he was physically ill. And of course, the actual term that which you'll pick up from him in his oral history is, we should have kicked Richard Nixon while he was down. And I just get so angry even discussing Richard Benvenisti. And I'm going to give you a perfect example why here. Jill Winebanks is going to discuss these documents that Jeff Shepard has discovered that have been, by the way, that were turned over by the National Archives that we use throughout this series. Just so you know, if you go on YouTube, you can find where the National Archives has allowed Jeff Shepard to do lectures from their building. That is not an endorsement of anything, but it certainly says that these documents are, in fact, real and been verified as being real, that were turned over when Mr. Shepard did a petition the government to have access to all the notes.
As to these documents that Jeff is referring to, they have long since been debunked and denied. There is no truth to them. They are not representative of what he is alleging was said. And I think that if you want to have a fair discussion, you need to have the people. I was not one of the people who was ever at a meeting like that, so I can't comment from personal knowledge. I know from talking to Richard Benvenista that that is not what happened. There was no secret ex parte meeting. No one on our staff would have ever agreed to do that, ever. So it just isn't true. And it's one of those things where you can say it loud and you can say it often, and he can repeat it again now, but that's not going to necessarily make it true. And I would love to have someone who has personal knowledge of this respond to it.
Now, she claims in this that that no one on their staff would ever do something like this, and yet the documents show that they did it over and over and over again. Not to mention that Judge Sirica was giving them advice and helping how to maneuver their case in the court system. It's disgusting when you really look at it. And the thing is in their oral histories, most of the time these prosecutors don't deny what they're doing, the meetings that they're having. But one of the things that's kind of interesting about her use of Richard Benvenisti as a person who apparently his credibility is beyond reproach, and so therefore he can vouch that these documents aren't true. Well, he very interestingly was on a show called Tricky Dick. It was a documentary on CNN. And actually, it was a discussion after the documentary that had Tim Naftali, the historian, on it. It had Carl Bernstein, it had John Dean, and it was emceed by Anderson Cooper. What is very interesting, and I'm going to let you listen to the clip at the end, was that Benvenisti will make a comment, or he'll talk about John Dean's credibility as though there has never been a moment that it was ever questioned from the moment that he stepped forward. And yet, and I'm going to do some shorthand. This is an introduction. You'll hear it read in full if you come in and listen to the show and the series as it comes. There's a document. There's almost 100 lawyers on the Watergate Special Prosecutor's Task Force at various times. So, you know, maybe Benvenisti, under normal circumstances, could claim that, hey, this document, it was to some lawyer, I didn't know about it. But he can't do this because it was written by a gentleman named Peter Wright, and it is addressed to Richard Benvenisti. And not only is it addressed to him, the title of the document is Uncorroborated Statements from John Dean. That's the memo here. And I'm going to let you listen to a little piece of this and then what he actually says on national television.
Watergate Special Prosecution Force Memorandum to Richard Benvenisti, date February 6, 1974, from Peter F. Wright. Subject: material discrepancies between the Senate Select Committee testimony of John Dean and the tapes of Dean's meetings with the President. The following are the material discrepancies between John Dean's Senate Select Committee testimony concerning his meetings with the President and the facts with respect to those meetings as reflected in the White House tapes in our possession.
But when Nixon says we may need it someday to correct the record, almost prescient, because his thought, once Watergate happened and once John Dean was going to testify, was that they could use the tapes selectively to undermine John Dean's testimony.
But of course, and that blew up.
That's exactly
everything
right.
Everything that John said in his aired remarks, not knowing, and answers to questions, not knowing for sure that there was a taping system, was corroborated. He was the most corroborated witness I've ever had in 50 years of practicing law, Anderson. It was astonishing.
I couldn't
lay a glove on him on cross-examination at the trial.
I could have laid a glove on him if they'd have had me on that show, because I'd have read the Peter Wright memo, and John Dean would have had to answer for it, and that guy would have had to answer for it. And what makes me angry is that, first of all, Anderson Cooper, the journalist, should have known and should have been able to ask a question. But because he did not, I would say 999 out of 1,000 people don't know about that memo and would have never known about it if not for this show and the work of Jeff Shepard and ShepardOnWatergate.com. And I would invite you to go over there to verify the work that we will present to you over the next 5 months, 6 months, because it is right there. The Wright memo is there in his collections, ShepardOnWatergate.com, www.ShepardOnWatergate.com again. I would suggest you go over there. But that is the type of thing that these people have gotten away with for 50 years. Well, the day of that free reign is over. And it is something that you will see that these prosecutors, these disgusting people, do over and over and over again. And I'm lifting my veneer of trying to appear a non-biased or whatever, but it is something that will anger you as you see this unfold when you think of Richard Nixon, President of the United States, getting us out of Vietnam and fixing the errors of judgment of previous presidents. And these very people, Robert F. Kennedy's people, that made up so much of this prosecution force, they're the party and the people who led us into Vietnam, and Richard Nixon got us out. And you look at this, it's absolutely disgusting and appalling. And what you will find is collusion going on between the Watergate special prosecutors, the judge, and John Doerr, the head of the House committee that would vote to impeach Richard Nixon, in the committee before he, of course, resigned. And it's interesting to hear how they put their case together and how intimately this connection between Henry Ruth, who was a special prosecutor, but he was a more of an administrator, and John Doerr, because they had been friends prior to this case, going back to their days when they lived in New York.
Tell us about, you mentioned earlier that you knew Mr. Doerr from, I guess, the time when he was working with the Bed-Stuy Foundation or Bed-Stuy Project.
No, I got to know him as a neighbor, really. And then in Mississippi. In Mississippi in 64, when Doerr was coming down there, he called me and said, I'd like you to ride around with me. And so I rode around Mississippi with him for about a week or two.
So tell us about, would you describe him as a friend of yours at the time?
Yes.
Did you find out from him that he had been selected as majority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee staff inquiry?
I probably read it in the newspaper and called him.
Leon Jaworski later recalled that Mr. Doerr was frustrated by the materials that had been turned over to him by the Senate. They're complex, complicated, very difficult to load through them. Do you remember, did he ever talk to you about the difficulties that the committee was facing in making sense of all the materials that they were receiving?
Well, sure. And I tried to help him. I thought they were doing a substantive job and would have tremendous difficulty. It was pretty obvious that the Republican members of the staff and the Republican members of the committee were still totally supporting Nixon and didn't believe any of our evidence, or said they didn't. So I wanted to help John. And I remember he told me one time that John Doerr's son, when John was out one night, he called a member of our staff to babysit his son. And John said the staff member had told his son that night, tell your father to subpoena the March 21 tape. So everybody wanted to cooperate, because they knew Doerr would do a good job.
You must have told him, or sorry, did you tell him in that early period how important the March 21st tape was, since it had been so important to Leon Jaworski? And he'd heard, Leon Jaworski had heard it in December of 73. So you were talking to John Doerr subsequent to that. Did you let him know how important that tape would be for his investigation?
I'm sure I did. Over this table.
viewers can't see it, but the table here. Tell us about the table here.
Well, John and I met for dinner at my house a number of times during that period. And we would sit at that table and eat and discuss Watergate.
As you can probably tell, we have a number of terminological inexactitudes going on here. If you take Jill Weinbanks at her word that no one on their staff would do any of this colluding. Well, it sounds like they're doing it all over the place and from every direction. And what's interesting, John Doerr, and I really struggled when we were doing this show to give him the benefit of the doubt, because he is a central figure in the civil rights movements in the decade prior. And a reputation for honesty and integrity, and you want to believe that perhaps he got hoodwinked here or manipulated. But what he did, because he is the head of the staff for the congressional committee, is he controls the information flow that the Congress people will see. And what he decided to do was not research anything, but collate it, put it together, and control what the congressional people saw and read. And, of course, what they saw and read, they had confidence in. And you'll hear this with one of the congresspeople that we used their oral history, Elizabeth Holtzman.
How did the committee choose which tapes to listen to?
We listened to the tapes we had, which were given to us by the Watergate grand jury. We received evidence from the Watergate grand jury. They turned evidence over to us, and among the some of the evidence they turned over to us included the tapes.
So now you get the feeling, you get a sense of what's going on here. You've got a judge, John Sirica, who we've not talked about this introduction that much, but he's presiding over the case. He's making life tough on the defendants. He's doing all this, but he's also secretly meeting with the prosecutors. Now, the prosecutors are also, because they're secretly meeting with the judge, and they got the judge helping them move this case along to get at the president and the president's men. You also have them meeting with John Doerr, who will in turn control the information flow going to the politicians who have to make the tough decisions. And then, of course, you know, how are you going to survive in a court case when the judge is in it, went on it with the prosecutors? It is crazy what's going on. But, you know, there are people who objected to that, to what's going on here. And it's interesting because 50 years down the road or 40 years down the road, when they're doing oral histories, they may not want to throw John Doerr under a bus or what have you. But two people who came out in our series, and you're going to listen to them, one of them is going to shock you, Hillary Rodham Clinton, did object to some of what they saw going on. And I would tell you, as you listen to these shows and these oral histories when we get there, pay attention to Bernard Nussbaum, who sadly passed away while we were in production. But he will tell you, always you have to read between the lines. And so there are going to be people out there who say, well, but he does say, hey, it was right the way it went in 73, 74. But I have this issue and this issue. And that's true. He does say that. But, you know, if you're capable of reading between the lines, you will hear it in what he's saying and his objections to how John Doerr decided not to investigate this case and his opinions about the Watergate Special Prosecutor's Office. It should terrify every free-loving American in this country.
When I think back, he was right most of the time, and I was wrong most of the time. He wanted to be, he understood that we couldn't come off as prosecutorial. He understood, and this is very important, he really understood, and Rodino did too. I understood it to some extent, but less so. He was, I understood what he was saying, and I sort of agreed with what he was saying, but I still wanted to be more aggressive in terms of the investigation. He was very cautious about how we should investigate this thing. He understood that the papers would be writing if we sent out investigators. He basically wanted to do it in a low-key fashion, have the information collated from various sources, especially the special prosecutor, who ended up giving us a sort of a report, some sort of roadmap, so to speak, although it wasn't really easy. So, and then, of course, we got the tapes. We didn't do a lot of original investigation. We did some, but not very much. We interviewed the witnesses, obviously, before John Dean and John Mitchell and people like that. But we didn't go out to aggressively investigate the facts, which is something I wanted to do. I felt we had to do. This is my background, but as a prosecutor, as a private lawyer, Doerr was much more cautious about doing it, knowing that we send people out, there'll be newspaper stories, who knows what we'll get, who knows how we'll be attacked. So he was to just take it step by step. Other people were gathering information, or information was coming in. Let's just put it together. Let's just collate it, and we'll present it in a neutral fashion. That judgment, some of which I opposed at the time, I realized after it was all over, happened to be a correct judgment. And I think it was very helpful in achieving what was the ultimate outcome. That is a dangerous office to exist for a president to have to face. When you start appointing independent counsel, the dynamic is such that you want to make a case.
You want to make, when you only have one target and your reputation sort of is at stake, you want to make a case. It's a, the impeachment process is a proper process. But the independent counsel is a dangerous thing to have because you have to have a unique person in that position who will walk away without making a case, especially when the president's involved.
A dangerous, dangerous office. That can't be overstated. And you'll hear, and I suggest when you listen to this broadcast, when we get to it, listen to Bernard Nussbaum. His oral history is stunning for what he, you can tell his objections to things that were going on and his fear of special prosecutor's offices. And when you look at it, as we go through this, you're going to hear about secret meetings between the judge and the prosecutors, evidence, exculpatory evidence being hidden from the defense not being allowed to hear certain aspects of the case, them proceeding with a hole in their timeline that would have exonerated Richard Nixon, and they hid that from the defense and from really Congress and everyone else while they made the claim concerning hush money. You'll learn about the real circumstances surrounding the smoking gun tape and how it is not what it appears to be. And you'll hear it from John Dean.
Now, that piece of tape that we just heard has come to be known as the smoking gun tape. I need to remind our viewers, the tape was actually made 5 or 6 days after the break-in, wasn't revealed until 5 days before Mr. Nixon resigned. So there was a 2-year gap there.
Right.
Why do you take issue with that? Why do you think it was not that damning piece of tape?
Well, when you hear the whole conversation, he's actually following my advice. I was passing on what John Mitchell, the former attorney general, thought he should do. And in doing so, I was doing it based on my belief that the reason we were concerned at the White House was because of potential Campaign Act violations. Contributors were going to be uncovered as a result of the FBI investigation that we were particularly concerned about. This was something that I had an agreement with the Department of Justice several days earlier. They would not investigate.
But in suggesting that the deputy director of the CIA call up the acting director of the FBI, that's clearly using one government agency to block the investigation of another.
A week later, it would have been a misuse of an agency. At that time, we were very confused as to what the CIA did know, didn't know, how involved or not involved. We didn't have the answers. And in fact, there is documentary evidence where that says that they're not even sure at some early stage like that. So I don't think it was an obstruction. It was defensible by Nixon at that point.
All of this together is going to leave you just dumbfounded that this could happen in the United States of America. And I've had a lot of people tell me, because people want to give the justice system the benefit of the doubt or say to you, our justice system doesn't work that way. Something like this would not happen. This is too big a grand conspiracy. Well, the truth is that it didn't have to be a big grand conspiracy. Things like this happen in courtrooms all the time. And it just needs a couple of folks trying to get a prosecution to work together to have something like this happen. And it happens in the modern age.
It's in the election meddling case against former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants right here in Fulton County.
The House Judiciary Committee is now investigating Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. And Atlanta News First anchor and attorney Joy Lim Nacker joins us now with the latest on all this. Joy.
Blair and Sean, just within the last few hours, Congressman Jim Jordan, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, announced the investigation. In a letter, he expressed concern about politically motivated prosecutions and potential misuse of federal funds. And this comes just days after one of the defendants in the election interference indictment moved for his charges to be dismissed over an alleged improper relationship between Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade and Fulton County DA Fonnie Willis. The committee cites this alleged relationship in its letter and states, quote, "We believe that you possess documents and information about the coordination of the Fulton County District Attorney's Office with other politically motivated investigations and prosecutions and the potential misuse of federal funds," and goes on to state, quote, The committee has serious concerns about the degree of improper coordination among politicized actors, including the Biden White House, to investigate and prosecute President Biden's chief political opponent. Now, DA Willis has been subpoenaed to testify in Wade's divorce proceedings. Neither has responded to the allegations. We do know Wade was in court today during the latest hearing in the Georgia election indictment. Political reporter Doug Reardon will have a closer look at today's court proceedings live at 5.
It also happened in 1944. And as a companion to this introduction, we've got another show called The Fort Lawton Massacre that we invite you to listen to concerning a man named Sam Snow, and it'll involve a prosecutor named Leon Jaworski.
You know, I didn't sleep well at night. I think you think about it every, all day, all the time. It never leaves you. I couldn't get no military job. I couldn't work no civil service for years. But I wasn't bitter because a man hired me as a janitor at a church.
Snow heard last month that the U.S. Army would finally make amends.
I got the news from Jack Hammer. He told me I was exonerated, and I was glad, and I was uplifted, and a burden came over me.
A man named Samuel Snow in Leesburg, Florida, received a check from the Army earlier this week after he was exonerated in October. It was meant to be the final chapter of a story that started over 60 years ago at Fort Lawton in Seattle. Samuel Snow was one of 43 African-American soldiers convicted of rioting and lynching an Italian POW during World War II. It was the largest and longest court-martial of the war. Snow served jail time, was dishonorably discharged, and spent some 60 years living the legacy of that conviction.
Again, please tune in to the Fort Lawton riot episode. It's about 17 minutes. It's very short. That will accompany this introduction. And you'll learn about the character of Leon Jaworski and him hiding evidence and putting 44 African-American soldiers in jail for something they did not know, did not do, and that he knew they did not do. So when somebody tells you that this doesn't go on in our justice system, and it wouldn't go on with the Watergate special prosecutors, everything you need to know is in that 17 minutes. And everything you see happening right now in President Trump's case also smacks of what we saw happen in Watergate. But we have something that, while it was deviously used during Watergate, proving to be exculpatory. And that's how we're going to end this show, with an interview with a gentleman named Dwight Chapin, who's been such a friend to this podcast, talking about these tapes, the Watergate tapes, and the fact that now that they're not being sealed for 20 and 30 and 40 years, now that we can listen to them all, we're finding out that there was a lot more to this story. And as I said at the beginning, Richard Nixon is being vindicated every day. More and more and more evidence is coming out that is showing that Watergate was in reality a situation where the heroes got treated like villains and the villains like heroes. But that was the first 50 years. Now, the truth has finally come home. And we hope you will tune in with us between now and August, so you can hear the real story of Watergate from this podcast, which has been one of the most extensively researched podcasts ever done on Watergate. And it's going to change everything you thought you knew about Richard Nixon.
I was stunned. I had no idea, Dan, that the taping mechanism was in place. The people that knew that, it was a very small group of people. I immediately thought this is going to be interesting. I did not know what would come of it. I will say this, and I cover this in my book, the tapes are going to end up perhaps being a blessing as time goes on, because the tapes, as we get into more and more of them, are starting to provide us material that is exculpatory for President Nixon. I mean, what happened with the prosecutors, and when these tapes were put out, that they did these slices of the tapes all of which shows the abuse of power and so forth. But they don't show the complete story of what was going on within the presidency and how some of the comments fit into context. So I think there's a lot of road to travel here. We're 50 years into it, but we're a long way from getting to all of the bottom level of what this thing was all about.
Yes, sir, we're trying to reach Dean. I think I could maybe if we get him, I hope, before he seems to be in transit from someplace to someplace. But I will, I'll report to you after I see him.
Very good.
Anyway, in the meantime, on Liddy, I don't know the man, of course, and have no control over him, but help, you were to tell him the president wants everybody involved in this to everything they know. Okay?
Indeed, so. I'll get in touch with the lawyer first thing in the morning.
I do it tonight.
Very good.
I want to fart around, okay?
Very good.
Do you think that's the best thing to do?
Indeed, so.
Fine. But one thing I want to be sure is that Henry understand. As far as Liddy is concerned, I don't know. I have no control over him. I don't know the man at all. And I just want, but since he has raised the question that maybe, not talking because of me.
No, I didn't leave that impression.
Because of Mitchell.
He's taking orders from higher authority.
Well, my God,
he's changing his mind that since you're the highest authority,
fine.
You know, he'll stand in line.
All right. You
he'll
just
be handled discreetly.
I just want him to be sure to understand, as far as the president is concerned, everybody in this case is to talk and tell the truth. That you're to tell everybody. You don't even have to call me on that with anybody. You just say those are your orders.
Very good.
Fair enough?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right, thank you, sir.
Henry, I've been talking to John Dean and I'm quite finished, but he stepped out for a minute.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you this. He says that he thinks it's important that I tell Liddy's attorney, I don't know who he is by the name of Marullis, do you know him?
Yes.
That what I told you a few minutes ago, that he's
still.
Huh?
Yes, we're already trying to get in touch with him.